Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I always feel like an indictment's going to come
Not guilty, Your Honor.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Phil Bronstein, editor-at-large of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I will be moderating today's program. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce journalist, political, economic, and cultural commentator and author Michael Kinsley. His latest book, as the title more than suggests, zeroes in on a thorny but fascinating economic and cultural topic or thesis, how to make capitalism work philanthropically or not. There's a bit of debate in the book about that. And like a lot of his work over several decades, the book really provides some interesting debate and discussion collected in the form of blog postings, I guess would be fair to say. The book is called Creative Capitalism, and everyone should buy a copy to see how the wealthy and their chroniclers see things these days. Mr. Kinsley's reach in the political and journalistic world is really long and deep, as most of you know. He's kind of a media polymath. There are really few places where he hasn't made an indelible mark, sometimes with some controversy, which we'll get to. He's currently a contributing columnist for Time magazine, served as former editor of the New Republic and Harper's, as well as editorial and opinion editor at the LA Times, an experiment we'll also probably talk about briefly. He's American editor of The Economist magazine and managing editor of The Washington Monthly. And in addition to Time, Michael has written for The Wall Street Journal, Times of London, The New Yorker, Reader's Digest, Condé Nast, Traveler, and others. And as you probably also know, he was on the forefront of online journalism, founding Slate, the nation's first online magazine, and serving as its first editor. And TV journalism as well. He served for 6 years, some of them probably very thanklessly, as the liberal half of CNN's Crossfire team, appearing opposite Pat Buchanan, John Sununu, Robert Novak, and other people who are popular in San Francisco. And despite that heavy deck, he more than held his own, even at a time when liberal was probably a dirty word in public. Before that, he often appeared on William F. Buckley's firing line, when he was really a pup, and he and his wife make their home in Seattle, Washington. Please welcome Michael Kinsley.
Thank you, I would be totally flattered if I was sure what the word polymath means.
I wasn't either, and I was hoping you did.
Oh, well, anyway, Phil Bronstein is a legend in what used to be called the newspaper industry, and it's a thrill to meet him.
Well, thank you, Michael. I've never been praised and buried in the same sentence before.
It's not your fault.
That's a relief, because I was thinking it was. Some people think it actually is. We have, I can't help but ask you about the really extraordinarily entertaining scandal, and I'm going to mess up his name, which is a shame, because he is going to become, I believe, the icon for something. Governor Blagojevich. Does anybody know how to? That guy, yes. Governor of Illinois. It seems like we have set kind of a new record for sort of brazen, self-destructive corruption, political corruption. On the other hand, it seems the polar, what this guy was into was the polar, allegedly, was the polar opposite of altruism, which, of course, is kind of one of the topics of your book. And if one exists, then we can have some hope that the other does, right?
Well, you could call what he did creative capitalism. but allegedly did. They've got him on tape, I guess. It's not really all that creative. It's the old-fashioned, it's almost a parody of what some people think about Chicago. He offers to sell political positions. I wouldn't call that terribly creative.
You would call it brazen. I mean, the guy seemed to know that he knew he was being investigated and seemed based on some of these wiretaps to know that he was probably being listened to, and he just didn't care. I think that really, you got to give the guy something for that.
Well, you know, it may, I mean, I don't want to libel Chicago. It may be that, but if you can't do that in San Francisco, where can you? It may well be that,
Detroit,
you know,
probably.
He didn't, oh, well, I grew up in Detroit there. We had a good one there last year. Although that was also traditional. That involved a woman. And maybe, you know, if you grow up in that culture, you don't know that you're not supposed to sell Senate seats.
Well, his predecessor clearly didn't know that because isn't he in jail at this point? Well, we talked a little bit. That's, you can go from that story to just about any interesting story. We talked a little bit about the Tribune Company and Sam Zell, who it's unclear may have actually declined the governor's offer to help him with the sale of Wrigley Field if he got rid of some journalists that the governor didn't like.
Yeah, we were talking about that, and you were with great strain saying Zell might have done the right thing.
Well, I just feel that when someone is always portrayed as a villain, that you got to give a little sunlight in there, the possibility of good behavior. Because, I mean, again, in creative capitalism, good behavior is one of the things you're counting on.
Yeah. Well, I worked for the LA Times, which is owned by the Tribune Company, for a brief time. And I was prepared until today to think that Sam Zell wasn't totally evil. And, you know, that there were even arguments that could be made that the L.A. Times was overstaffed. I ran the editorial department, and we had 15 people putting out 18 editorials a week. So that meant each one had to write about 500 words a week. And, you know, if someone wanted to say that was overstaffing, I would find it hard to deny that. Now, of course, I think the entire staff of the LA Times is about 15 people, and they've gone far enough. And Zell, I think it's just truly, he ought to be taken out and shot, because
the opinions of the guests on the show don't.
Yeah. You know, and I agree with you in general that people are complex and motives are complex and so on. But, you know, he arranged for the Tribune Company to be owned by the ESOP, by the employee stockholders. They had no say over this. And now, not only is their retirement pension worthless because the employee stockholder thing owned all its assets were invested in Chicago Tribune stock, but if they took the buyouts that many of them had been offered, which the company urged them to take, they're now unsecured creditors, and they're even behind Sam Zell in line for money, and so that is really
creative capitalism.
Yes.
Yeah. You've said both before the election and probably after, I'm not entirely sure, but that you were pretty enthusiastic about the victory of Barack Obama. And I just wonder whether Obamania doesn't bother you at all. You did write something about his smoking, and I think half jokingly or entirely jokingly said, you know, you have to have some skepticism about the guy. But the smoking thing turned out to be more, I think, arch than genuine skepticism.
Well, I couldn't prove that he still smoked. And and even if he did, I sort of reached the conclusion it was his smoking was less of a risk to his health than his needing a cigarette might be to my health in a crisis, you know. I confess I'm a swooner like many people here, I suspect, and it's a novel experience for me. I you know, the last president anyone on the liberal side could swoon for or did swoon for was JFK. And I was too young for that. And Clinton, who's my only past experience in even voting for someone who went on to win, his honeymoon lasted about a day. And I think everyone, well, my position was, I'm for him, just don't tell me anything about him. And that turned out to be a good position to have about Clinton. So Obama is the first one to come along that I really can swoon for, and I have.
Well, I think in the case of Bill Clinton, although there are a lot of Bill Clinton supporters still in San Francisco, that if you were going to swoon over him, you'd have to get in line behind Bill.
Yeah.
Is the problem. You know, in the book, and I want to ask you more detail about the book in a minute, but there's a sort of an overarching question in creative capitalism. The thing that struck me about the opening essays by Warren Buffett, and particularly Bill Gates, and after reading some of the later posts in the book that were critical, it seems like, you know, you have these two gigantic business titans, wildly successful, a little naive about the prospects of big scale, you know, doing well and doing good. That, I started to wonder, what are these guys smoking during the bridge games? That they, you know, do they live in a world that's a little too rarefied? Because authors afterwards say, you know, this is just not a feasible.
Well, what exactly struck you as naive? I mean, I'm not saying you're not right. I was just the editor of this book. I don't defend any particular passage. But I've never heard Bill Gates called naive before.
Well, I've never thought it before until I read that. And it just seemed that the idea that you could rely on, I mean, you know, there's discussion about taxation, corporate tax. There are some practical schemes to make this happen. Although I think Warren Buffett suggests that there ought to be a corporate tax, and then there ought to be someone from the corporate world who oversees that tax, and that seemed to me to be like fraught with problems in this day and age.
Well, that discussion at the beginning between Bill Gates and Warren Buffett is, I think, one of the more interesting things in the book, because if you read, I mean, Warren Buffett is a very close friend of Bill Gates, and he's given Bill all his money to give away. So clearly he trusts and admires him. But reading between the lines, you sense that he doesn't buy a lot of Bill's recommendations. And, you know, there are other ways to go about things. Two of them are sort of discussed in the book. One is, you know, the way a society ought to work, and I'm very sympathetic with this view, is you figure out what you want done that doesn't happen through the free market, and you figure out how much it's going to cost. Then you have an election and a government, and the government raises taxes to pay for it, and you do it. And that's sort of how they do it in some European countries. You know, the government takes it upon itself to make sure people have health care, to pay for medical research, and to help poorer countries. The other approach, which, you know, is an alternative to this idea of creative capitalism, is actually what Bill Gates did as opposed to what he says you should do, which is he started out as a capitalist, and he was a very successful one for a few decades, and then he took the money he made there and he became a philanthropist. And he's spending that, I think, equally effectively in Africa and in the United States and other places. And, you know, Clive Crook, who's a very good economic writer, says in the book, if Bill Gates had done what he says that other people should do, Microsoft might not have happened and he wouldn't have the money to do the good he's doing now.
Okay, so you articulated the point about being naive better than I could have. I mean, that you could strike you as a naive position. Another thing, Gregory Clark, who's an economics professor up here at Davis, who you cite in the book, who has an essay in the book, he says, he talks about several problems with the Gates theory, and one of them is a kind of paternalism where Gates' proposal assumes that poor people in Africa don't know what's in their own best interest, but, you know, capitalists in the United States do.
Well, that's a problem with some people think with foreign aid in general. You know, that it's arrogant for rich countries to go into poor countries and say, we're giving you this money, but only on condition that X, Y, or Z. And I think that's probably often the case.
Well, but bad foreign aid policy is, you know, that's
has
a great
dog
foundation.
Bites man.
And this is something that you're talking about creating from something new.
Yeah.
It just seems to me, you know, why do you want to adopt old bad habits?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. You know, saying I don't can you ever say I don't know on television? That just seems like something that's not allowed.
Have said it on Crossfire, but you can get away with it on Charlie Rose or something. Yeah.
Actually, I'd like to hear Charlie Rose say that on occasion.
No.
Since you bring up Crossfire, your parents wanted you to be a doctor, I heard you say somewhere, and
So you think this is the polar opposite?
No, I don't. I don't. You're cutting me off
past.
I'm sorry. But no, it's okay. There are some people, and I've heard you very articulately talk about the value of Crossfire. There are some people who feel, that was kind of the beginning of the gladiator style of TV news, where you had people, and it was just a softer, perhaps more intellectual version of Hardball. That things evolved from Crossfire to, you know, people screaming at each other and interrupting each other.
I actually think Hardball's pretty good. I think Chris Matthews, the host of it, is he's nuts. But he has an interesting mind, and when he's bringing up crazy things and interrupting people, it's because his mind has gone somewhere. That's not quite what I mean. His mind has gone somewhere interesting. And for Crossfire, I do defend it, because. Well, politicians who came on that show knew they couldn't get away with filibustering or evasive answers because, you could be asked tendentious questions, basically. And typically in these shows, either it's Meet the Press and the reporters who ask the questions are supposed to be totally neutral, or it's Hardball, where it's really about the host rather than the guests, and you don't get to ask questions, and you have to pretend to be omniscient. I think it's very funny to watch all these shows during the current financial crisis, and we need some funny stuff there, because they don't have any idea, and I don't either, and maybe you do, and to hear them, you would think that they were total masters of derivatives and how the auto industry works, and they're bluffing. And you didn't have to do that on Crossfire. You could reveal your sincere ignorance.
Well, there's a pretty good theory that the automakers have no idea, and the derivative masters don't understand what they were doing. You said in a 2006 Time column, "Do newspapers have a future?" Sorry to get to something that is concerned to me immediately. Newspapers are on the way out, but maybe not newspaper companies. Some are going to find the answers. The New York Times just hocked its building to stay in business, and the Tribune Company has filed for bankruptcy. So do you still believe that some newspaper company is going to find the answer?
Yes. It'll probably be some newspaper company that no one has ever heard of. I mean, someone's going to crack this nut, and then their whatever they figure out will be duplicated, and the New York Times will buy that company or simply steal its ideas, and the Tribune Company will be long forgotten, and that'll be it.
You also said that the New York Times will be the last serious newspaper.
Yeah. I said that?
Yeah. You did. You did. Do you want me to... I can.
No,
look.
No, I believe you. Was well, all right.
Okay. On the...
It already is, you could. Some people might say.
Well, I'm not. I wouldn't be one of them for obvious reasons, yeah. But you might be right. Your own newspaper experience, at least at the LA Times, what were you thinking?
You mean the Wikipedia?
The Wikipedia thing. I mean, you know, why did you not think that you would be inundated by pornography and crackpots?
Well, I guess in hindsight, that was a failure, but I didn't. It never occurred to me, and it never occurred to maybe 20 or 30 people who were involved in doing this. And we publicized it in advance, and we never heard anyone from the San Francisco Chronicle telling us, watch out, you're going to be inundated with porn.
We could have told you from experience that that's what happens.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So why do you think that, I mean...
Maybe I should just explain for one second, just in case people aren't... I don't know how they could be unaware of this. we did this experiment where we took wiki technology, which essentially allows anyone who wants to amend a document, and the Wikipedia is sort of an inexplicable success. It turns out it's not perfect. But even so, it's really remarkable that it's as good as it is when it's sort of written totally by volunteers who are virtually anonymous. We thought, well, we'd try this with an editorial. So we put up and we bought the technology and we put up an editorial about the war in Iraq and invited people to amend it, and for two or three days it was really interesting. Someone came in and split it in two to have a pro-war and an anti-war editorial, and that was a good idea. It didn't occur to us to be a little hard to incorporate both those views in one editorial. And others, but then on one Saturday night, people started flooding it with really horrible pornography. The newsroom lawyer at the LA Times said she was a First Amendment absolutist her whole life, but having read this stuff, she came in Monday morning and said she's starting to have doubts. It was really awful, and we had to give it up. But there are people... You know, the first people to try things often get it wrong, and others are trying this experiment, and it's working. You know, they have gates to keep people out and various things. And, you know, you have to encourage experimentation if we're going to find a way out of the current mess that newspapers are in. I think you have to try everything. So we tried this and it didn't work. And, you know, it didn't bother me at all. But it bothered some people, like the Tribune executives. and so...
Have you ever looked up your own wiki bio?
Yeah, and it has some mistakes in it.
Did you fix the mistakes?
No.
See, that's what worries me. Mine does too, and I haven't fixed them either. So I'm just that worries me a little bit about the wiki model. But it's as you say, you know, it's an experiment. The other great experiment that you undertook, of course, was Slate, which is now successful, making money, right?
I don't know if it's making money now. It was making money 6 months ago.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
But that would be considered a successful
Yeah, I think it is, and it was bought by the Washington Post company, a real journalism company. I started it at Microsoft, which didn't really know what it was doing. It was just trying at that point to hire journalists.
Yeah, you had there was a memo that you talk about at one point in some interview I saw that Slate was going to be changed once a week.
Oh, yes. Well, my first job, I showed up and didn't even have a name, you know. But I sat down in an office, a little cubicle with a computer, and wrote my memo about what I thought this online magazine should be. And it was just completely wrong. It said, I imagined it at the very beginning as something that you would print out once a week. Yeah. And most of that real nonsense was gone by the time we actually launched, but not all of it. We had page numbers so that you could flip through. But, you know, the conventions of print have been in place for centuries, and to the point where you don't even think about it, you know, that you read from left to right, and you have page numbers, and you have tables of contents. All that stuff had to be invented. And the Internet is starting to develop some conventions like that so that you don't have to sort of reinvent. You don't have to be Gutenberg to start a publication anymore.
Well, you talked about, you know, you said after that, long after that, actually, that you had a lot of new ideas or a lot of ideas for new journalism, and you talk about experimentation. You said, you know, you give you six techies and six journalism students, and you could come up with an interesting idea. You have the URL News Kitchen, which you assume plan to use at some point for something, and I'm just wondering what, if you could share an idea.
Well, if I had a really good idea, I wouldn't share it.
That goes against the notion of creative capitalism, and somehow, I think.
Well,
it
violates transparency, which is the ultimate goal of everything, it seems.
Well, let's get to a few audience questions. As a fellow veteran of the LA Times, would you talk about the toxic nature of celebrity journalism, cash box or balance sheet journalism, and journalism by amateurs? That's a big question, multi-part question, but any part of that you want to tackle?
Well, I actually thought the LA Times didn't do enough celebrity journalism, because it seemed to me that its best hope was to be, it had the franchise, or it should try to claim the franchise, of being where you go for entertainment. If you look at the news, if you look at the three or four biggest papers in the country, you can't buy the LA Times, which at that time was one of them, outside of Los Angeles County. You can't buy it in Washington. You can't buy it in New York. And of those papers, only the LA Times and the Washington Post don't have national distribution. So how can you be a national paper without national distribution? The Washington Post, the Internet has enabled it, saved it really, at least for a while. But it has the conversation of Washington, and people read it because they want to know what's going on in Washington. And I think the Los Angeles Times, the only way it was going to be saved, and now it's probably too late, is if it became the voice of the conversation in the media, celebrity, techie, you know, incorporating Northern California.
Whoa.
Set of it. Well, you may have things to worry about, but the LA Times is not one of them.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you worked for Microsoft, which funded journalism in the form of Slate. These, not so much Microsoft, but certainly Google and Yahoo. I mean, Yahoo's in some trouble these days. Google has said, we're not a content company. You know, we're not going to create content. We're just going to aggregate content. And we in journalism would like to think that they're going to come to their senses one day and not create content, but understand that they need to pay for our content. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that is ever going to happen, but is there going to come a time when these portals, which have new aggregated news, mm-hmm. are not going to really have a lot of professional
nothing,
news?
They're not going to have anything to aggregate.
Well, they'll have amateur. They'll have, you know, citizen journalism or whatever, yeah. however you want to term it.
Well, I think something like that is where this whole thing's going to end up. I think the model of the news consisting of stories written by professional journalists who get paid, for example, and is probably going to evolve in some ways toward the whole blogging world, where it is amateurs sitting in their boxer shorts opining. And, you know, it may not be so terrible.
Which is interesting, because this question just came up. I was going to ask you, you've talked about the blog clog, that there are just too many blogs. And I don't necessarily agree with your notion that it makes reporters work too hard. I don't think that's a bad thing. And I think in many cases, bloggers, maybe in the minority of cases, but bloggers have held some media organizations accountable. But this question, which comes from the audience, Mr. Kingsley, you recently wrote in Time that there are too many blogs. Same story I was talking about, column. Are you also against the rise of the printing press? So this is obviously a blog person.
No, I was very careful in that piece to say part of the problem is that not only are there a lot of blogs, but there are a lot of good ones. And when are you going to read them? And it was a humor piece, or it was intended to be a humor piece. Seems like it was an ill humor piece, maybe. But is there anyone who can honestly say they feel caught up in their news reading? It's hard, and it's precisely because a lot of blogs are really good that you feel bad if you haven't checked them out every day. And that was my point. Oh no, I think A.J. Liebling has famous line. The freedom of the press is for those who own one. And now everyone can own one. I think it's great.
Well, there also was another a quote that has been around for decades, which is, you never mess with people who buy ink by the barrel. And I think that's no longer necessarily true. This is because the last person took a little bit of a shot, so let me read this question. You're charming and brilliant.
Oh, that's much better. That may be my stepdaughter.
Please don't identify yourself and pop the bubble here. What books, magazines do you recommend for me to read to expand my knowledge and intelligence?
Well, you got the San Francisco Chronicle,
and
you have Slate.
You are charming and brilliant.
Yeah, and you have Slate. I don't have any original ideas. I suppose you ought to read the New York Times. And, it's precisely because you can't read everything you should that you have to sort of triage. And if you find something that, grabs you, I read L.A. Observed every day, which is a blog about politics and the press in Los Angeles, even though, it doesn't do me any particular good, just because it's very well written and because I have this morbid interest in the L.A. Times. So you find something that tickles your fancy. And also, surfing is great. People used to worry, when this whole business started, I'm sure you remember, Phil, that if people are not getting their news through newspapers, and if they're able to sort of design their own newspaper, they're just going to read about sports, basically, that people's interests will narrow. And the great thing about newspapers is you'll read a story, you'll be tricked into reading a story that you didn't know you were interested in. And that's true. That is one of the great things about an old-fashioned newspaper. But that hasn't happened. The fear that people's interests would narrow because of surfing. You know, you very rarely make it through a whole article without clicking and going somewhere completely different. And that's one of the great things about the internet.
You keep plugging the New York Times. I have to say, I mean, you're right about the LA Times never fully embraced or understood its main industry in Los Angeles. But the New York Times, you know, I don't know if you saw it a few weeks ago, had a magazine cover piece on Angelina Jolie. And not only was the big photo completely glam, I mean, clearly approved, et cetera, but the story began by saying, you know, in person she's much more beautiful and much more charming. And the piece went on
in that
vein.
Is this wrong?
Well, I don't know that it's wrong, but I think we talked earlier about people are complex. And I will say on their behalf that a couple Sundays ago they had a piece on Mickey Rourke that was pretty textured, you know, and held his feet to the fire a little bit as a real person instead of a cartoon character.
Well, the Times Magazine, I sort of pray every week that there won't be anything interesting in it because then I have to read it. It can be really, really good. It runs very – it's them and the New Yorker and maybe the Atlantic is sort of it for long-form narrative journalism. And sometimes they do a great job, and sometimes they don't. It's sort of separate from the rest of the paper, isn't it?
I guess it is. I mean, you also mentioned the Washington Post. I mean, it should be said that while there's great work going on there, I never could understand Len Downey's refusal to vote as part of his, you know, journalistic creed.
But was the previous editor. He didn't vote because he felt that was a conflict of interest. And he even didn't. He went out of his way not to decide who he might vote for if he was into that sort of thing, because that was a conflict of interest.
I've never known an editor that's had that much control over their own behavior. Here's another question from the audience. Do you think that modern capitalism can survive the current crises?
Yes. I don't think anything that's happened, certainly so far, really threatens capitalism. Now, I think that's a good thing. Maybe some people think it's a bad thing, but I think it's true. Capitalism is here to stay.
And the bailouts? I mean, maybe the newspaper industry needs a bailout.
Yeah, well, you know, I had that never occurred to me until today. And, you know, you see the word bankrupt, and there's this whole discussion going on about should we let the auto companies go bankrupt? And is this a good thing or a bad thing? And then a newspaper chain goes bankrupt, and, you know, there's no debate.
You know, there probably is a reason for that, and some good reasons and some bad. But in creative capitalism, in your book, you know, you talk, or a number of people talk about corporations, businesses exist to maximize profit. And if you take away from that by getting them into some kind of altruism, you know, you're undermining their fundamental reason for being. Now, newspapers are a business. And clearly, at least until fairly recently, in most cases, maximizing profits was not at all the only mission of newspaper companies. You think that's kind of what happened, that they just became
too greedy,
unsustainable business as well? I mean, greedy.
Or they never could have made it if they were held to the standards of hardcore businesses. Is that?
Well, no. The idea is they always, you know, maybe I'm naive about this, but they always had a mission that involved serving the public by doing journalism. And so maximizing profits and doing journalism suddenly seem to have become irreconcilable.
Well, John, the editor of the LA Times when I was there, man, I'm sure you know very well, John Carroll, great newspaper editor and a wonderful man, very wrong about this particular point. He thinks the answer is to get back to the days of the benevolent family owners. And I think one lesson of the Tribune saga is that the benevolent family owners will sell you out in 2 seconds. Certainly after we were talking about this before, after a generation or two, there's going to be a cousin somewhere who's going to say, you know, I think I would like to cash in my stock.
Or every cousin.
Yeah.
Somebody asked about
Wall Street Journal.
What about the New York Review of Books? But which would that be on your list of?
Oh yes, it's. But of course, I don't subscribe because I read it for free on the web.
You're part of the problem.
Yeah.
You've talked about. You have a very interesting notion of that reverse snobbery is the worst kind of snobbery. So Bill O'Reilly pretending that he comes from a hard scrabble background when he doesn't. Mm. But let's talk about snobbery for a second, not to suggest that you're a snob. But, you know, we've had this mix in our culture lately. I mean, the National Enquirer broke the John Edwards story. One can argue all one wants about was that a legitimate story to run. I mean, I think it was.
Yeah, me too.
But it came from the National Enquirer. It didn't come from the Miami Herald, which busted Gary Hart. It didn't come from the Washington Post or the New York Times.
I think it actually came from the blogosphere originally. A friend of mine runs a blog. His name is Mickey Kaus. He runs a blog that they run on Slate called Kaus Files. And he pounded this thing every day. And the blogs eventually made it impossible for the mainstream media not to cover, to ignore that story. And I think that was good. I'm sure there are other stories that the blogosphere has forced the mainstream media to take seriously, where I wouldn't feel that way. Matt Drudge started all this.
Another question.
Yeah, and I wrote a piece when he first appeared. He was quoted somewhere saying he was 80% accurate, and so I thought about that. I thought, well, maybe there should be a place where you can publish things that are 80% accurate. You know, it's not that the mainstream media have a standard of 100% accurate. They have two standards. One is for what they'll print in the paper and tell their readers, and another is what they will tell each other around the water cooler or whatever. I'm sure at the Tribune today, maybe even at the Chronicle, there are details about this governor story that everyone is swapping, and they're not, you know, because that's what you do. The water cooler has maybe a 5% accuracy rule. So what would be so terrible about having an 80% accuracy rule for some media, and then, you know, there would be media that, like the major newspapers, which would try to have 100%.
You know, there are a lot of newspapers these days and newspaper editors who exhort their staffs to be more like the water cooler. You know, if you're not doing the water cooler conversation for your readers, then you're missing out. And I don't know about that. I have complicated thoughts about that notion, but
What are they? Because I think it's an interesting question.
Well, I mean, there is a theory. Okay, it's my theory. About the higher calling disease that journalists have caught in recent decades. It's like the Len Downey doesn't vote idea, where, you know, there are stories that are too icky to touch. You know, one of your writers from Slate, ex-writers from Slate, Christopher Hitchens, was here at Berkeley during the Lewinsky-Clinton scandal, arguing forcefully that every lurid detail of that story should be made public not because it's fun but lurid, but because the convergence of sex and politics has been of interest to people for 5,000 years, and why do you pretend it hasn't been?
Yeah, well, certainly your first question when you're trying to decide this is this interesting? And you know, if it's interesting, then you ought to, at least that ought to be a first step towards publishing it. Now, you know, there are other, it might be interesting but untrue. That might be a reason not to publish it. Or it might be interesting but icky. I think there's some point where the story would get too icky. But on balance, I mean, you ought to publish. And now I think there's no point in even arguing about it because the blogosphere will force it out.
How about reality shows? Have you watched any? You don't. You're not interested in reality shows?
No, I'm not even interested in reality. In San Francisco, there's a large contingent that wants to ignore reality.
It's a long, rich tradition here.
Yeah.
What about the notion that that reality shows and that kind of culture is a big part of where we are right now? And you ignore them at your own peril because you don't get a big window. You narrow your window. Now that's your choice. But you narrow your window on the culture. In other words, if you're not paying attention to what popular culture is paying attention to,
Well, if you look at today's newspapers, front pages, most of them have the Tribune story, which is of great interest to journalists. My wife is always telling me that this is you people writing about yourselves. And there's a lot of that. The other story that was on the front page nearly everywhere was the Jay Leno story. And that's a good example. I think 10 years ago that would not have made the front page of the New York Times. I think they're clearly trying to do what you just said, write about popular culture because that's what your readers are interested in and it's important. USA Today, I think, does a fantastic job at this. When I look at USA Today, their front page, I'd say one time, at least once a week, they've got some story there, which I look at, and I'll say, that never occurred to me, but that is really the story that everyone wants to read. What do you think about that?
Well, I thought that's what Hal Raines got fired for as the editor of the New York Times, was putting too much culture on the front page.
Oh, well, maybe.
I'm a big fan of culture on the front page, and, different people define it differently, so that's why there are, often vivid arguments in newsrooms about what story should go on the front page.
My first day at the New York Times, L.A. Times, and there was a Freudian, the L.A. Times, I went to the page one meeting, and there was a great story they were talking about, a little gruesome, about a guy who, it was a Hollywood screenwriter who'd written The Three Stooges Meet Godzilla or something like that. And someone broke into his house, sawed off his head, put it in a bag, and then later escaped and he was caught because he said he was sitting in front of the security camera at one of the movie studios. And the guard... who had the security camera and then a monitor and then another TV where he was watching a reality show probably, which he wasn't allowed to do, and he spotted the police drawing on the TV and this guy sitting on a bench with a bag in the studio, and this guy was captured. I'm listening to this narrative, and I'm thinking, what a great story. and so I was waiting to see how big it would be on page one. And this was the L.A. Times. They didn't put it on page one. And so I asked John Carroll, who do you have to decapitate to make page one around here?
Sometimes it's all in the writing.
Yeah.
You had a couple of very powerful essays about Parkinson's and about your Parkinson's. One was Defense of Denial, where you talked about initially denying that you had it or not saying that you had it. And then you had one, Mine is Longer Than Yours essay in The New Yorker, which was a little bit about life expectancy and actuarial odds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also, a very candid assessment, but it did not offer a lot of emotion. I mean, you were sort of irritated that because of the statistical side of life, Robert McNamara got years that should go to somebody more deserving. But I'm just curious about, did you go through kind of the stages? They talk about the stages of, because denial was certainly one, anger. I mean,
Well, I got stuck on denial.
Oh.
And I got a good 10 years out of that. So so that was...
Is there a tendency to want to, having not denied it, having stopped denying it, do you feel that it drives you in any way? Do you feel like people, you know, you want to establish that it has not affected you intellectually?
Oh, sure. And, you know, especially on a book tour, when you're in front of audiences, you know, I will confess that, I time my pills and whatnot. You know, Parkinson's, the medication is very, very short term. You take a pill and you're fine for X number of hours. And so you really can time it. And, you know, I'm vain enough so that I timed it so that around 6 or 7 tonight, you know, they'd be working well. And I think that strategy is working for me at the moment. And then I had an operation a couple years ago, which I mentioned in the New Yorker piece. Editors, I mean, are very eager to... You know, I tried to leave out that completely in this piece I wrote for the New Yorker, and they said, well, can you just put a paragraph in, or you said something that was interesting, add another paragraph. There's a bit about this operation there, and they put wires down into your brain, and there's I have two batteries here.
And you're awake and alert when this is happening, right?
I wouldn't say alert. You're awake. And the operation is unpleasant, but everything else about it is sort of fun. And so I wrote about that a bit.
And you're working, writing, but you're a prolific writer, obviously, so that there hasn't been any effect on your...
Not that I know of. You know, how can you tell?
You know, I found a quote of yours as I was reading the book and looking at some other things that I thought was interesting. You it was at Berkeley a few years ago, and you were being interviewed there. You quoted, you said you thought it was British economist Joan Robinson as saying, "The purpose of studying economics is not to be fooled by economists," which is a great line, but, you know, your book is full of economists.
And, well, they didn't fool you, did they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, did they fool you in any way?
Well, I actually don't think that's true of economists. I think it's true of lawyers. And I went to law school, and one of the advantages is, you know, I can't be buffaloed by lawyers, or at least I can't as easily be buffaloed by lawyers. I think everyone should... The ignorance of economics... you know, how supply and demand curves, the most basic knowledge of how economics works is really, it hurts our country, and especially the ignorance among journalists. I begged, you know, the interns who came through the various publications where I worked to go back to college and take Ec 1, because it really, more than any other, it's the one social science that's closest to a science, a genuine science, in the sense that it has predictive value. That's the test. And if, you know, I studied a bit of economics, and I still can't understand what's going on now, but I think I have a little bit better sense of it than if I hadn't ever studied it.
Well, it's interesting, because you said in the intro to your book, which it seems like you were writing... as recently as September. Hmm. Maybe by the time you read this, the financial crisis will have been over and it'll all have been a media-induced panic.
Well, that's wrong. I did say maybe.
You did?
Same way we say allegedly when we talk about the governor of Illinois.
I have a feeling that those tapes will be as eagerly listened to as almost as the Nixon tapes. Did you see Nixon Frost?
Not yet.
Do you want to see him?
Yes.
Are you fascinated? Do you remain fascinated with Richard Nixon?
I'm probably just barely too young to have been a Nixon fanatic. My first political memory is of my mother, my kindergarten teacher, telling me that Eisenhower had saved us from the Nazis. And I asked my mother who she's voting for. This would have been 56. And she says she's voting for Adlai Stevenson. And and I asked her, how could she do this when Eisenhower had saved us from the Nazis? And she said, oh, Eisenhower was okay, a lie. She couldn't stand him. But oh, that Nixon. And it made a big impression. It was the first time I'd ever seen either of my parents have that kind of passion about politics. And they were just, you know, they weren't political people especially. And it was about Nixon.
Yeah. I found myself inexplicably on Hardball the other night. And
you mean you just woke up and there you were?
I'd like to say that because that would excuse what happened. But, you know, I was Chris Matthews' editor when he started his journalism career at the Examiner in San Francisco. And one of the things he did was went in and actually listened to a recently released batch of Nixon tapes. This was in the 90s, where there were smoking guns, you know, possibly for the first time, really smoking guns. And he had great stories. And he asked me the other night something about Nixon, and he referred back to those stories. And, of course, I was being TV, I was completely inarticulate. But he basically said, you know, why do we still have a fascination? But the answer I would have given is that, you know, we have, as a culture, an interest when a celebrity gets a bad facelift. Mm. But the total disintegration in public of the most powerful person in the world seems to me to be something that's going to be eternally interesting.
I'll buy that.
Okay, good. That's a do-over from Hardball, just in case you.
I know that feeling. I had that feeling. I'd say 4 nights out of 5 when I was doing Crossfire. And there's the French have this phrase, esprit d'escalier, meaning an idea on the staircase. It means you're going up to bed and you think of the great zinger you should have said at the dinner party that night. And I suffer from that all the time.
Well, you know, they had a, when there was, I remember, if you remember the debate, when they were going to replace Nightline with Late Night with David Letterman. And, of course, people who respected Ted Koppel and watched Nightline were appalled. But somebody wrote in a column, may have been the LA Times, actually, something I think was really great. And they said, you know, I'll believe that there's a fundamental difference between Nightline and Late Night. The first time Ted Koppel says to somebody, you know, Ted, that's an interesting question. Let me think about it and get back to you.
Yeah,
and that just doesn't happen on TV.
No. You should try it.
No, it won't work. Certainly won't work for me. Getting back to your book, there's a sentence in there about Bill Gates believing that it's, and seems logical and rational, that helping with disease in faraway lands is more urgent than the local opera company. Well, let me play devil's advocate, since a supervisor in San Francisco proposed today a 25% cut in funds to the opera, ballet, and symphony, making a pitch for the survival of local culture. You got all these foundations. Their portfolios have tanked for the most part. And what do you think is going to be, again, going to sort of the idea of public good and altruism, what's going to be the future of places like, you know, the opera, the ballet, the symphony, or the arts?
Well, it depends on how hardcore you are about this, and I guess I've gone a little soft, but the hardcore argument would be the average attender of ballet must have an income. I mean, sure, there are people who scrimp and save to get a ticket, but by and large, the average income of a ballet goer must be higher than the average income of a non-ballet goer. So why can't the ballet goer pay for his or her own ticket, whatever it costs? And why should the non-ballet goer subsidize the ballet goer? Because the money has to come from somewhere. And if the government pays for it, it means that the non-ballet goer is paying for it. And if a foundation pays for it, they are, you know, those dollars are finite, and it means that, you know, less is spent on, you know, malaria in Africa and some of these things that Bill Gates is spending money on. One of the very, I sort of think it's quite courageous of Bill and Melinda Gates that they say no to, for example, if you go to the very nice new Symphony Hall in Seattle, there's plaques for Boeing all over the place and Howard Schultz of Starbucks. And Bill and Melinda Gates, I don't think gave them, I think there's a corridor or a bathroom somewhere that's Bill and Melinda Gates. And, you know, it's because they don't go, and they didn't, and they felt they didn't want to subsidize it just because out of embarrassment or anything. And I respect that.
You know, you say in your book in relation to that the two forces in human nature are self-interest and caring for others. And capitalism makes self-interest serve the general public is kind of the idea that some folks in your book espouse. But it just seems like, and others argue in your book, that there's a vast imbalance between the urge, the self-interest urge, and the sort of altruistic urge, and that you really, I mean, neither Gates nor Buffett nor anyone else has come up with a way to equalize those.
Well, I think that's what the book, I mean, what not the book, this is what Bill Gates, by raising this notion of creative capitalism, is trying to do. Adam Smith is the one who first wrote about all this, how self-interest capitalism is a process that takes self-interest and turns it into serving the general interest. And, you know, you can see all sorts of proofs with graphs and charts and so on. It's really an extremely powerful idea, and I think it's by and large true. He's trying to push it further, and he says, well, in addition to self-interest, we all do have an interest in caring for others. May not quite equal our self-interest, but it's there. And, you know, with certain adjustments, capitalism can serve those interests too. That's the idea.
Do you think the timing is bad, given the sort of the crash of the faith-based economic system?
Yeah. Well, I've been on this book tour for the past couple of weeks, and I'd say half the people say your timing is really bad because this isn't a moment when capitalism is exactly held in high esteem, seems to have screwed up in various ways. And then the other half say, boy, your timing is great because we have all these problems that we didn't have before that it can apply itself to. I prefer the second view.
Go with them.
But I think I may believe the first.
This is a question from the audience, and it's something you and I talked about briefly beforehand. What do you think of the change of the Wall Street Journal since the purchase by Mr. Murray?
I hate to say it. I think it's gotten better. What do you think?
I think it's gotten more interesting.
Yeah.
How diplomatic is that?
Yeah.
Right. Not very much. Another question from the audience, which kind of gets into what you were just discussing. Trickle-down Reaganomics obviously doesn't work. Why would trickle-down capitalism work? Isn't it inefficient?
Well, Reaganomics was a parody of capitalism. And if it didn't, I mean, it did, of course it didn't work. Capitalism is a much more rigorous idea. Reaganomics, you know, can mean almost anything. But I don't see how anyone could really think that anything that's happened so far disqualifies capitalism. I don't know.
We have and Murdoch. You're sort of okay with him as the last remaining press baron.
Well, you know, you got to judge by the result, and the Wall Street Journal is a great read. Now, of course, he broke all his promises almost immediately about, you know, consulting with this board. I hope you weren't on it.
A board of...
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Well, I think they were... the board, I remember, what was the deal? He was supposed to he couldn't fire the editor without consulting.
Yeah, that lasted about a day.
He
and a
broke
half.
All those promises. But the paper is fun to read.
It is fun to read. I agree. Unfortunately, we're down to the last question. And I will ask you this. This is my own question. On Crossfire, is there a position you would take today that would have put you on the other side of the table on Crossfire?
Is there a position I would take today? You mean, in other words, have I moved right on anything?
Yes. Everybody needs an editor. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of any. I'm sure there are issues in which I've moved right, and there are probably issues in which I've moved left. I think I average out about where I always did, which I think is I'm unreliably left of center.
I think your antagonists there, like Mr. Novak, have not changed at all. Anyway, our thanks to Michael Kinsley. Thank you, Michael. Columnist for Time Magazine, founding editor of Slate, author of Creative Capitalism.
Thank you.
We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Phil Bronstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Here we go.